WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's summer, finally, and time for that much-needed and much-deserved break. Some of us go to the beach, some head for the mountains, others stay close to home and lounge by the pool or perhaps a favorite spot in the park. And along with the sunscreen and the bug repellent and the giant cooler, most of us also pack at least one summer book. Ah, summer, a time to escape, be enlightened, and learn. And this summer, as usual, the selection is large, and for some books, the hype is even larger. Muggles across the world will be standing in line tonight to be the first to get their hands on the fifth installment of Harry Potter's series, The Order of the Phoenix, while other fiction fans might turn to a big buzz first novel by Carolyn Parkhurst, The Dogs of Babel. If you're a history buff, perhaps you're packing up the new big biography on Benjamin Franklin. While those looking to relive the 1990s might want to read about the Clinton years with Hillary's new memoir, or perhaps Sidney Blumenthal's The Clinton Wars. Whatever your preference, this summer's bookstores are chock full of hot new offerings. And tonight, On Point, we're going through some of the biggest, best, and most hyped reads of 2003. So what book is on your beach blanket this summer? Does the hype around a book make you want to read a book more? Or is it an instant turnoff? And how important is reading to your summer schedule? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now in the studio is Carol Horn, head book buyer for the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome, Carol.
Oh, thanks, Gail. Glad to be here.
And from Chevy Chase, Maryland, we're joined by Deidre Donahue, a book reviewer for USA Today. Welcome, Deidre, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Well, it's great to have both of you with us, and I want to ask each of you this question first. I have to wonder whether perhaps American readers are a little bit like lemmings in terms of, you know, we want to read what everybody else is reading so we can talk about it, or just feel as if we're in the know because we are reading the big, hot summer book. Carol, what do you think?
Well, there's certainly some of that always. I mean, we certainly don't want to seem as if everybody is reading something and we're not. But I think that there are a lot of things that people can pick out this summer that aren't the big hype books, but that are really fun and entertaining and informative.
Deidre, what's your sense of that? Do you try to pick the really popular book that everybody's talking about?
Well, to be honest with you, I stood in line for 5 hours interviewing people about why they were buying the Hillary Clinton book. And I was very, it was a book signing on Capitol Hill, and I was very surprised at the intense feeling of support that so many women felt for her. I mean, that this was really, they didn't seem to be sort of doing this because of the hype or because they had seen her on Barbara Walters. It was much more that they wanted to show that, you know, they felt that she had, I mean, people were saying things like, you know, she'd gone through the fire and she was still standing tall. I was amazed at the intense personal connection that a lot of people felt with this. So I actually think that, you know, there's certainly been enough books that have been heavily hyped that have, you know, just tanked. So I think that people do, I mean, at a certain point, I think people do feel, you know, I should read Seabiscuit. Why does everyone seem to love this book? But then it's a fabulous book, so I see nothing wrong with that.
And then they get the answer. Well, let's talk about fiction, first of all, because there are so many terrific books out right now. Carol, what are your two top choices for the summer?
Well, my top choice is a book called The Clearing by Tim Gottro. He's written several books, and one of those people who has gotten great reviews but not the sales that are commensurate with those kind of reviews. This new one, I think, is the book that could break him out and could get him the attention that he really deserves. It's a story of a Philadelphia family that's torn apart by the effects of World War I on the older of two brothers. And it's set in the deep cypress swamps of Louisiana, and it is marvelous.
That's always a great setting, don't you think?
I do. I mean, I grew up near there, so I particularly like it, but I don't think you have to have grown up near there. My other top pick would be Sherman Alexie, probably our foremost Native American fiction writer. He has a new collection of stories out called 10 Little Indians.
And we know him because he was also the wrote the screenplay for Smoke Signals based on some of his earlier short stories.
He did, yes. Yep. And he's just a marvelous writer. He goes back and forth between novels and stories, but I personally think that his stories are the best. It's modern day American Indians and the things that they're contending with, mostly in the Pacific Northwest, but a few that are other places.
All right, Deidre, what are your top
two
fiction choices?
Well, it's interesting because I actually, Sherman Alexie had also been on one of my top ten picks. So I also really enjoyed his writing and also those short stories, but also the sense of humor. I had not realized what an incredibly sort of ironic, funny, self-aware writer he was. I actually adored a book called For Matrimonial Purposes, and it's by an Indian writer who talks about, she's the former fashion, CNN fashion consultant, but she spent a great deal of time in Bombay, and it's all about what's it like to live in two worlds. And what I loved about the book was it comes out from Penguin, and it really captures that sense. You know, the protagonist is 33 years old, and she's living in New York City, and her parents and her relatives are just in complete despair because she has not gotten married. And she goes back to Bombay periodically, and they try to set her up. But I love the way that it also captured that sense of what it's like to live in a society where people have the time and the energy to actually really care about what you're doing and whether you're married. Mm. And I love that. I found it a very interesting book.
And laugh out loud funny from some of the reviews that I've read.
Yeah, I mean, I really found it. It had a, she had a real spark. It wasn't hysterical, but what I liked about it was the fact that it conveyed to me the qualities of the strength of living in Bombay. You know, she didn't live in Bombay, the heroine, but she did eventually find an Indian man. I mean, that was something, you know, she was not marrying an American. That was all there was to it. And I love the way she captured that sense of community that I think, you know, you don't find in New York City.
And what else do you like?
I liked Sushi for Beginners. I have to say that I'm most excited about a nonfiction book, Under the Banner of Heaven. I'm a huge fan of John Krakauer, and that is the book that I'm sort of salivating to, you know, review and possibly interview him. So
now he did Into Thin Air.
He did Into Thin Air, and he also, I actually think his best book is Into the Wild, which is a book about a young boy who goes up to Canada on sort of a search to find himself and ends up through sort of a tragic accident dying, but starving to death. And it really kind of captured that sense of a young man's desire to prove himself. And John interweaves his own issues involving rebellion against his father, his passion for, you know, for climbing, danger. And I, who have no interest whatsoever in rock climbing whatsoever, really found it very insightful. Mm-hmm. Plus, now he's writing about Mormonism, and I thought he really, the sort of undercurrent of what he feels is some significant issues involving violence and polygamy.
Carol, I also want to ask you about last year, this time, all the big talk was about a whole new spate of first-time novelists. Mm-hmm. Are we seeing as many this summer?
No, we're not. We're seeing all those first-time novelists from this time last year coming out in paperback, which is wonderful. One of those paperbacks is on my top 10 list, Three Junes by Julia Glass, which won, what did it win? National Book Award for Fiction. And it's a wonderful story. And if you prefer to take a paperback to the beach, as some people do, it's certainly my top recommendation.
All right. I want to bring in Carolyn Parkhurst to the conversation now. She's on the line with us from Milwaukee. And Carolyn, your book, The Dogs of Babel, has gotten just a tremendous amount of buzz.
It has. I've been absolutely thrilled. It's just completely not what I expected, but I've been very happy about it.
Well, congratulations. And also congratulations because you wrote this while you were pregnant, and apparently it was something of a race to get it finished.
Yeah, I worked best under deadline, and it really worked well for me. I literally finished the book the day before my son was born.
Wow.
So.
Well, I wonder if you would do a brief reading for us and give us just a quick line on what the story is about.
Sure. It's about a man whose wife has died rather mysteriously, and he's trying to figure out the circumstances of her death. And it occurs to him that the only witness to the death was their dog, and that if he could teach their dog to talk, then he might have all the answers he's looking for. And the section I'm going to read is about the first time he meets Lorelei, who is actually the dog. The first time I met Lorelei, apart from the wary once-over we gave each other the day of the yard sale, was when I arrived to pick up Lexi for our first date, a date that, as it turned out, would last a full week. As soon as I rang the bell, I could hear the enormous noise of Lorelei's bark beginning at some distant corner of the house and moving with alarming speed toward the other side of the door. I took an involuntary step backward and cowered against one of the porch posts as Lexi opened the door. Lorelei bounded out and leaped toward me, landing with her paws just below my shoulders. I stood rigid as she peered up into my face for a long moment, no longer barking, and I felt an unexpected calm run through me as I met her eyes. For one strange moment, my anxieties about the evening ahead of me faded, and without even thinking about it, I reached out and rested my hand gently on her head. This is the beginning of our story, mine and Lorelei's, a story separate in many ways from the one Lexi and I would begin to create that night. For the first time, I looked into those earnest eyes and touched that rough, soft fur. For the first time, I felt a hint of tenderness for this dog who has, through time and the earthly miracle of canine trust, come to be my own. All that we are together now, the sum of our grief and our play, the daily movement of man and dog through an empty house, following the passage of sun from room to room until it's gone, all of it began that moment on the porch with Lexi standing in the background.
Carolyn, and of course we should note that you are one of those first-time novelists we were referring to a moment ago.
Mm-hmm.
How did you come up with the idea of a talking dog, and particularly, seriously, as also a device to deal with some much larger themes here of love and loss and
right,
grief?
Right. I knew starting out that it was going to be about a man who had recently lost his wife, and he's trying to figure out exactly what happened. And, you know, I wanted to write about grief because it's such a, you know, it's a universal human emotion, and we're all scared of losing the people we love, and I just thought that in his grief it might occur to him to do some things he wouldn't normally, you know, otherwise do. And, I think that anyone who's had a dog knows that dogs are kind of the witnesses of our lives, and you look at them and you say, I wonder what he makes of all this.
What's going on behind those eyes?
Exactly,
yes,
right. So that's where the idea came from.
Well, let me turn to Deidre and Carol and ask if you folks have had a chance to read it yet, Carol?
I haven't, but I read the review in the New York Times today. The New York Times has recently been extraordinarily, I almost want to say nasty, but certainly difficult with novels. And Janet Maslin gave this, a pretty terrific review.
I was
thrilled
with that.
So congratulations.
Well, thank you so much.
And Deidre, is it on your list?
Actually, my colleague, Bob Minzenheimer, is the one who I believe interviewed you.
Right, yes, he interviewed me for, yes, that's right.
Right, so we had her featured in our summer preview, but in a section that I didn't do.
Right.
So are you working on something else now, Carolyn, or are you going to kick back a little bit this summer and enjoy some other books?
Well, a little of both. I am working on a second novel, but it's very early on, and for the moment I'm kind of busy with my book tour and all that. But, you know, with all the time I've been spending on planes, it's nice to have some time to read for a change.
Do you feel a lot of pressure because this one is being so well received?
I do. When I start to think, is my next one going to have the same kind of hook, like, you know, the talking dog kind of thing? But I can't really think about that while I'm writing, or it will sort of paralyze me. I just have to write what I feel compelled to write about and just hope there's an audience for it later on.
And I have to ask, what are you bringing on the airplane or to the beach? It sounds like you're going to be spending more time on planes than beaches, but...
Right, right. I just finished a book called The Song Reader by Lisa Tucker, which was very good. It's about a woman who analyzes people by the songs that get stuck in their heads. And I also just started reading The Book of Salt by Monique Trong, which is about the chef of Alice B. Toklas and Gertrude Stein.
Well, Carolyn, thanks so much for joining us. I hope your summer won't be too jammed.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
And Carolyn Deidre, I want to ask you, too, to hold on. We have to take a little break here. We're talking this hour about some of the big summer reads of 2003. And we're wondering, does your favorite book last summer guide you in your book selection for this summer? And in uncertain times, do you look for a book for escape, or is your summer reading done to understand the world a little bit better? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255, and we'll be back after a short break. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are going through some of the hottest books of this summer 2003 and finding out what books you'll be bringing to the beach, to the mountains, or perhaps sitting around comfortably in your backyard reading. What are you reading? What are you taking with you? And does the hype around a big summer book make you want to buy it? Or does it become a turnoff? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. And we're joined this hour by Carol Horn, who is head book buyer for the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Deidre Donahue, a book reviewer for USA Today. And right now, we're also joined by Lev Grossman, a book critic for Time Magazine. Lev, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Gail.
Well, it's wonderful to have you with us, and I have to ask you, Muggle you, you've been waiting through the, well, I shouldn't say waiting through, you've been going through the new Harry Potter book, so was it worth the wait?
Well, I have a confession to make. I've worked for Time Magazine, and we had concocted a fiendish scheme for getting access to the new Harry Potter book early, which was we were going to have our confederates overseas, who have the advantage of being in a different time zone from us, Xerox, and then fax us pages from Harry Potter.
Oh, my gosh.
However, possibly due to the interference of Voldemort, those pages have yet to arrive through our fax machine. So I am not, in fact, at this moment clutching the new Harry Potter. I think I may be the only, we may be the only news outlet in New York City that doesn't have a copy.
Oh, and here you had this great plan.
We were all very proud of ourselves for thinking of that, but so far it has not borne fruit.
Well, Deidre, then let me turn to you, because you did figure out a way to get it. Maybe I shouldn't ask what your methods were, but...
No, our methods were simply buying it.
Really?
But I cannot tell you where I bought it, but it was a bookstore.
Okay, well, fair enough. So the question comes to you. Was it worth the wait?
Yes, and I did not like book four. I found book four grisly. I found it hurried. I found it churned out. But I found book five, The Order of the Phoenix... Really, I think she's made a very wise decision to have waited 3 years to publish it. I think it's far more similar to her first three books, all of which I liked very much. I think she has, I don't want to give away plot things because I know there's kids waiting for 1201,
sure,
including my son.
But can you give us a little sense of the storyline here?
Harry is 15. And he is an adolescent. And the book really, she has really evolved the book into a young adult novel that deals with alienation. It deals with disenchantment with people, including your parents. And it's a very, there's a, some very interesting activities involving sort of mind. It's somewhat similar to the first three in the sense that it opens at Privet Drive. It spends a lot of time at Hogwarts. It, you know, closes with Dumbledore sort of explaining things about Harry's past. What I loved about it, I've always thought that J.K. Rowling's genius is really her ability to create a parallel world where simple things, like, for example, how would Mrs. Weasley and her children clean a mansion that has been abandoned for years, and, you know, how would she clean this? And, of course, she has all sorts of wonderful, you know, charms that end up doing it. It's that ability to create a complete world that you actually, as, you know, we muggles, would love to live in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, it has, what I loved about it was that whole quality of there's enough similar character, you know, familiar characters like Professor Snape, but you learn more about him. You learn more about Neville Longbottom, who happens to be my favorite character. And the characters sort of evolve. So it has that nice quality that series often offer where you find, where familiar characters, you know, show new sides. And I think that's a real satisfaction in terms of reading series. I was very impressed, and I read every single word of it, and I enjoyed it, and I found it, I don't think it's a book for children under 10 years old, if that. I think it's very much a young adult novel, but it's not a, I found some of the scenes with Voldemort, from the fourth book to be too. I didn't enjoy. I thought that she diminished Voldemort's terror by having him appear too often.
Hmm. Lev Grossman, let me go back to you for a moment because I'm curious what you make of all the hype. I mean, does this make you roll your eyes, or when you hear about the midnight parties and so on, or are you in favor of anything that gets people to read?
Well, it's difficult to be cynical about something like this that gets so many people reading and getting their noses into books. There are horrible things about it. The hype is inherently distasteful, of course, and it leads to exaggeration and all kinds of other things that we'd rather avoid. But it's really it's hard to be grumpy about it because so many people are reading who might otherwise not be, and that is ultimately such a great thing.
Do you ever worry that the mega books like Harry Potter perhaps drive out some of the little gems that are particularly well written or wonderful stories as well, but don't get that kind of attention?
I'm sure it happens. I happen to be a big fan of Rowling's writing. One sees there are other good writers out there. Philip Pullman. Lemony Snicket is a lot of fun, and people find him. I don't worry that this Darwinian catastrophe is happening. Worthy books are being shunned to the side. If a book is good, they really do tend to find their audience.
Well, Carol Horn, you're one of the people who's having one of those midnight parties.
Oh, so. We are. We're starting at 11, and at midnight we'll rip open the boxes as Big Ben chimes midnight. I agree that with Lev that if anything, this has led kids to look for more things to read. And he mentioned a couple that are favorites of mine, but also the Artemis Fowl series has really caught on. And all of a sudden, reading is cool. And I think that's a wonderful thing.
Let's talk for a second as well in terms of the Hollywood connection, because one of the things that I've heard parents express, particularly about the Harry Potter books, is that the great thing about reading is it is creating a movie in your mind. And I think that's mm-hmm. why many of us are so often disappointed, because the movie that we go to see, no matter what it is, if it's of a favorite book, that's not our movie. That's somebody else's movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if that in some way detracts from the reading experience, Carol, because suddenly we know what Harry looks like, or we know what Harry looks like in Hollywood's version.
Well, it's an interesting question. I can't remember a novel where the movie version was so close to what I had envisioned people looking like, what I had thought Hogwarts would look like. It was sort of perfect in every way, and yet for me, there was some magic in the books that didn't quite make it to the movies. And I don't know what that is, just sort of the imaginative experience of reading. But, Harry, you're right. We now know what Harry looks like. Of course, we don't know what he looks like a year older, which we have to think about tonight.
Mm. So, Lev, what's going to be in your beach blanket collection of books?
Well, I said a moment ago that I felt like good books find their audiences, but there are a couple of incredibly wonderful books out this summer that haven't been getting a whole lot of buzz that I'm really very fond of. One of them is a thriller called The Winter Queen by Boris Akunin. This is a book that Akunin, which is a pen name, is something like the Tom Clancy of Russia. His books sell in the millions over there. He's fantastically famous and popular in Russia. And now, for the first time, he's been translated extremely well and released into the United States. And, so far, I really haven't, seen this book get a lot of attention, but it's absolutely magnificent. If you can imagine Turgenev or, another great 19th century Russian novel, taking on the sort of modern thriller genre, I think that's more or less what you get in The Winter Queen. I couldn't put it down, and it was a wonderful, it was pulse pounding, but also just gorgeously written. I couldn't recommend it highly enough.
That's a pretty strong endorsement. And Carol was actually nodding as well.
I think it's really wonderful.
Actually, Bob Minzenheimer and my boss, Carol Mamet, the book editor, both read it and loved it. They kept insisting he was sort of the Moscow John Grisham. I know Bob reviewed it and loved it.
Well, that's an interesting description, the Moscow John Grisham. Okay, we'll have to think about that a bit. Let's talk for a moment about nonfiction. What are you liking there? Deidre, maybe you can start us on that one.
Well, you see, now, it's interesting. I personally take nonfiction on vacation, and I very much like nonfiction. I am very excited about the Spartans, the world of warrior heroes of ancient Greece, from Utopia to Crisis and Collapse by Paul Cartledge. I loved Cicero by Anthony Everett, which I believe two big newspapers in London declared the best book of the year. It's all of them. It's just a fat, it's out in paperback this year, this month, maybe last month, but it was just spectacular. And so I think there's actually a renewed interest in the classical world. What are some other, well, I'm very excited about the John Krakauer book. I was a huge fan of the, you know, Seabiscuit, which came out in 2001, and I was surprised at how much the illustrated edition of Seabiscuit, bringing the photographs in, actually added to the enjoyment of reading the book, because they've re-released this very beautiful collector's edition, you know, obviously in time for Father's Day and for the movie. But I was surprised at how, well, for example, Laura Hillenbrand said, you know, the question she got a lot was, why don't you see the horse's face on the cover? Well, it was a very decided decision, because they didn't want people to, they wanted people to realize that this was a book about people. I mean, you saw the jockey, you saw the owner. They didn't want just horse lovers. They wanted people to realize that this was a story about why Americans connected so strongly with this racehorse during the Depression, and that quality of being game. But now, in fact, they have this, you know, you actually see Seabiscuit's face on the cover at last. So I think that, I'm trying to think of other books that people that are very. I'm actually sort of interested in the Ben Franklin book. I mean, I have to say that the success of, you know, David McCullough's John Adams book was certainly suggested that there's a massive market for serious books.
Carol, excuse me, let me just ask Carol to jump in on this one as well, as to your favorite nonfictions.
Well, I'm with Deidre on the Krakauer. I've read it, and not only is it a book about the Mormons, and there are some people who are putting it in the true crime category because there is sort of this appalling murder. But I think it goes beyond that, and it's really a look at the extremes of religious belief in the United States. And it doesn't go on sale until July 15th, but I think it's going to be one of the big books. Another thing that I'm really very fond of is a book called Reading Lolita in Tehran, a memoir in books by Azar Nafisi. She was a university professor in Iran, and for the 2 years before she left in 1997, she secretly met with a group of seven women who had been her students at her home to read and talk about the forbidden books of Western literature, The Great Gatsby, Pride and Prejudice, Lolita, and it's a marvelous story. It's just terrific. The other nonfiction that I'm very taken with is called Charlie Wilson's War by George Creel, I'm not sure. He's a veteran producer from 60 Minutes, and he has tracked down this untold story about what you could call the last battle of the Cold War and how it fueled the current jihad. Charlie Wilson was a sort of rogue, maybe we shouldn't say rogue, but a congressman from East Texas. And during the Reagan administration, he was on the Appropriations Committee, and he managed to get hundreds of millions of dollars, and with the CIA's help, to arm the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. And the results of that we're still dealing with.
I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to On Point. And we invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to hear what your favorite summer reading involves. And Lev, let me go back to you for a minute. I guess memoir also is included under the heading of nonfiction. There's one in particular that you've enjoyed by the same person who wrote, what was it, Running with Scissors?
Right. Running with Scissors was a big surprise hit last summer by Augustine Burroughs. And amazingly, about a year later, he has a new book called Dry, which is a memoir about alcoholism, which isn't a subject that you necessarily associate with light or pleasurable reading. But Burroughs is really just he's a terrifically funny and smart writer, very much in the David Sedaris mode. And he just has a knack somehow of having incredibly extraordinary things happen to him. And he talks about his experience with alcoholism. He was working as this sort of high-powered ad man, even though he had no college education. And he really just takes you through this wrenching experience of having to kick his habit, and he somehow you know manages it sort of alchemically to make it just incredibly compelling and funny and interesting to hear about. I actually like it better than Running with Scissors, which I wasn't such a huge fan of. So I definitely would recommend Dry.
And Deidre, you were agreeing.
Oh, okay. It was also one on my it was also one of my top lists because I really felt that we had selected Running with Scissors as one of our book club selections, so I had really liked it. But I thought that you saw the growth of an author in terms of writing about his alcoholism, and yet it's laugh-out-loud funny and also heartbreaking. I mean, one of the scenes he has where going to an AA meeting where a woman talks about, you know, she's dying of cancer and she wants to die sober, but it's not one of those sort of, you know, I've gone through rehab and now I've found God and I'm a 12-stepper. I mean, you know, he makes it very clear he had to stop drinking because he was going to kill himself. But he also continues to have a very wry sense of humor about the entire experience of, you know, going to this Minnesota rehab center, which it's not the Betty Ford. I mean, it's very funny about, you know, he talks about the food is hideous. The only person who likes the food and factors is a very funny English music editor / crack addict who becomes a very close friend of his. And, you know, they have little, you know, teddy bears that they, you know, but it really captures the sense of being in rehab, but also giving you a wonderful perspective of someone who has, whatever it is, clearly his sense of humor has kept him alive and functioning and very successful. And I thought that that book was really wonderful.
Well, you've both certainly made it sound very appealing. Lev, I just want to ask quickly, you know, there's this old saw about how beach reading is, don't make me think, I just want to turn the pages. Do you think that's really true, or do people want to be challenged even when it's hot out?
You know, I will go ahead and say that I'm not a snob about beach reading. There is stuff that is relatively brainless that you just want to absolutely inhale. It'll take you away to somewhere else, and it's not going to work you too hard. You know, that kind of book is out there, and I, you know, I'm a big fan of it. I'll quickly mention Girl Cook by Hannah McCouch, which is a book in the Anthony Bourdain mode, if you're familiar with Kitchen Confidential. It's kind of, if you could imagine that crossbred with Bridget Jones. it's a really effective and appealing hybrid.
Lev, we have to say goodbye to you. Thank you so much. Appreciate your being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll be back after a short break. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and this hour we're talking about the big summer books of 2003 and asking what you'll be reading as you enjoy your downtime these summer months. How important is reading in your summer schedule? Do you tend to cram it all into a summer, or do you tend to read differently during your summertime time off? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. And we're joined this evening by Carol Horn, head book buyer for the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Deidre Donahue, a book reviewer for USA Today. But first, I spoke yesterday with John Burdett, author of the new and much-awaited thriller Bangkok 8. It is the third novel by this lawyer-turned-author and getting a lot of reaction in the summer of 2003. I asked John Burdett if he's been surprised by the positive reviews for his book.
Surprised, but surprised in the sense that I had no idea at all how the book would be received. It's an unusual novel, and when you write an unusual novel, you just don't know how it's going to hit the market. So, yeah, surprised and delighted, but I really didn't know what to expect.
Give us a quick summary of the plot.
An African-American Marine is murdered. The murder weapon is drug-crazed snakes. The two detectives who are pursuing him, who find him in the car. One of them is killed by the snakes. The other detective decides to avenge his partner's death. His partner is also his best friend. This takes him on a long, extremely winding journey, not only through the Bangkok underworld and the sex trade, but also through the extremely wealthy members of the international jewelry trade, which, of course, is very alive over here because a lot of jewels are actually brought in from Burma, Laos, and Cambodia. So that brings in the international dimension.
I'm fascinated that your main character is a Buddhist cop, because that would seem to be the ultimate oxymoron.
It is to the Western view, but in fact, in this country, 98% of the people are Buddhist. The remainder are mostly Islam. So, in fact, every cop here is technically Buddhist, but I take your point. Not all of them are scrupulously follow the Buddhist path when they practice their profession. What's interesting about this guy, I think, is that trying to mend his karma because of an unfortunate incident in his adolescence. So he's more or less obliged to try to follow the Buddhist path at the same time as being a Bangkok cop. That's his dilemma. That's his problem. And to me, that's what makes him interesting.
Exactly. I was going to say he struggles with those two roles.
I think you'd have to. I mean, to be fair to the cops over here, they're incredibly underpaid. And we all know what happens when cops are underpaid all over the world.
Would you read a segment for us, John?
Yeah, sure. I will read what is the shortest chapter in the book. It's half a page. After we murdered the yerba dealer, our mothers secured us an interview with the abbot of a forest monastery in the far north, who told us we were the lowest form of life in the 10,000 universes. He Chai had thrust the broken bottle into the jugular of humanity, and therefore of the Buddha himself, while I giggled. After 6 months of mosquitoes and meditation, remorse had gouged our hearts. 6 months after that, the abbot told us we were going to mend our karma by becoming cops. His youngest brother was a police colonel named Vicorn, chief of District 8. Corruption was forbidden to us, however. If we wanted to escape the murderer's hell, we would have to be honest cops. More, we would have to be arhat cops. The abbot is undoubtedly an arhat himself, a fully realized man who voluntarily pauses on the shore of nirvana, postponing his total release in order to teach his wisdom to wretches like us. He knows everything. Pichai is with him now, while I'm stranded here in the pollution called life on earth. I must try harder with my meditation.
Congratulations, John. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Gail.
Again, that was John Burdett, author of Bangkok 8. And as we continue our book conversation with Deidre Donahue of USA Today and Carol Horn, head book buyer for the Harvard Bookstore. Deidre, I understand you have read Bangkok 8.
No, actually, I haven't read Bangkok 8. I am looking forward to it, but I have not. It is on my list.
I'm sorry. Carol has read it. Forgive me.
Yes, an amazing book. When he said it's unusual, that's certainly true. I read the first 10 pages, maybe, in which this murder happens with the snakes. And
pretty exotic way to go.
I almost put it down and said, you know, this is a little more violence than I think I'm up for. But it stuck in my mind, and I went back to it and just sort of read it start to finish. It's an amazing book. It's really quite special.
Let's talk for a moment about Oprah, who has now revived the book club, except now instead of focusing on what's new, she's going back to some of the classics. And her first choice was East of Eden, which came out in 1952. And it's going to be interesting to see how people respond to that. What do you think, Carol? Are you stocking up a lot of copies?
Well, we are stocking up. I mean, I'm frankly quite pleased that she's going back to the classics. Whether it'll work or not, I'm not quite sure. But I'm sure that we'll sell more East of Eden than we would have otherwise. But it's a very interesting idea. And I think this first choice is really quite interesting, not at all in the vein of the things that she had been picking. I think it'll be a lot of fun.
And in fact, she describes it as one of the best novels she's ever read.
Well, I haven't read it in a very long time, but I remember it as being pretty great.
All right. We have a caller who we'd like to hear from. Laura is on the line from Hopkinton, Massachusetts. Hi, Laura. What are you reading?
Well, I just actually picked up the new Margaret Atwood book, Oryx and Crake, which I'm very excited to read because I love Margaret Atwood. It's actually a continuation of one of her previous books. I don't know if you folks have heard of it. And I'm also reading a book that's about a year old called Hateship, Friendship, Courtship, Loveship, Marriage.
Alice Monroe.
Yeah. Those are the ones. And, of course, the Harry Potter when it comes out.
Yeah. And what did you think of the Alice Monroe book?
I'm loving it, actually. I'm almost done with it. I'm loving it. It's very well written.
Well, happy reading, Laura. We're happy to hear from you.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks so much. I'm also told that there is a new Prince William book coming out today, and it's sort of the illustrated version of his life. He turns 21 tomorrow. Deidre, I don't know if you've seen it yet, but as I heard some of the publicity for it, I just, you can't help but think, oh my goodness, you know, is he going to be subjected to the same amount of attention that his mother was? And the answer is probably yes.
Well, it's interesting because they do say actually that he's very close to his father, and that I don't actually cover the British royal family. I actually do more on the Kennedys, but it is interesting how he's a remarkably photogenic human being. I'm afraid to admit that. In fact, I've mostly seen pictures of him. I haven't read that much about him. I mean, he is, you know, just handsome. One hopes that, you know, that he doesn't end sadly the way his, you know, his mother did. And
well, just in terms of being subjected to so much publicity, I mean, you know, she, as we know, couldn't set foot anywhere without 9 million photographers around her.
But you know what's interesting? The Sally Bendell Smith biography of her, I thought, was very insightful, where it talked a lot about how people that she did develop a, according to Smith, and I think she clearly knew what she was writing about, I thought that was a very insightful book that suggested that it was a two-way street, that she wanted the attention. I mean, I'm always fascinated that I guess John Profumo, you know, works in a hospice, you know, in East London. I mean, I think that certainly that, you know, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis was photographed a great deal, but I think that when one doesn't give interviews, when one does try to live a fairly private life, granted, could you live a private life as, you know, the ex, you know, Princess of Wales, I actually think that sometimes fame becomes an addiction.
Hmm. Well, Carol, let me ask in the few minutes we have left to talk about books. Fall is apparently going to be just astonishing this year.
I went to the Book Expo, the Booksellers Convention, and I have not seen a fall this good in 5 years, I don't think. There are any number of fabulous novels. Toni Morrison has a new one. It's been quite a few years. Jhumpa Lahiri, whose last book, Interpreter of Maladies, won all kinds of awards and was incredibly popular, has a new novel. Peter Carey, who won the Booker in 01 or 02 for Ned Kelly's Gang, has a new one. John Updike has short stories. Tracy Kidder, who with John McPhee is one of those nonfiction writers that I'll read anything he writes about, is writing a wonderful book about a Boston doctor named Paul Farmer, who's an amazing person, has worked with poor people in Haiti. Paul Krugman, the New York Times columnist, has a new book. Gore Vidal has a book, not his like his recent ones, sort of anti-Bush, anti-war, but about the Founding Fathers.
Well, so we'd better get all of our summer reading done pretty quickly, hadn't we, if we have all of these goodies coming up in the fall?
I would certainly say that the Jhumpa Lahiri book is certainly the top of the list for a lot of people, that she really has a fresh and original voice.
Well, it's been such fun hearing from each of you as to what you're looking for, and happy reading, everybody. Thanks, Carol Horn.
Thank you.
Carol Horn is head book buyer for the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And thanks to you, Deidre Donahue.
Oh, well, thank you for inviting me.
Deidre is a book reviewer for USA Today. And to take a look at the top summer book picks by Carol and Deidre and Lev Grossman, or to continue the conversation, you can visit our website at onpointradio.org. This is On Point. Just outside Tulia, Texas, population 5,117, is a sign that reads, "The richest land and the finest people." Well, that genial declaration has become a bitter irony since a hot July day in 1999, when more than 10% of Tulia's African-American population was arrested in a drug bust. No drugs, money, or weapons were seized in any of the cases. The first tried in the sting were sentenced from 20 to 341 years, based solely on the testimony of a lone investigator who kept no audio or video recordings, but wrote notes on his leg. Other defendants took pleas, ending in sentences of up to 18 years in prison. A pro bono legal team pushed hard to discredit the testimony of Detective Tom Coleman and reopen the cases. Now, 38 of those charged may be exonerated when a Texas Court of Criminal Appeals decides whether to vacate the earlier convictions and order new trials. This week, 12 defendants were released on bond. 26-year-old Kizzy White received a sentence of 25 years. She was one of those released on Monday. And in this radio diary, Kizzy White talks about her first taste of freedom.
That's just a horrible feeling, being in prison, almost four years in prison behind this drug charge. I have two kids, Ronisha, she's 9 years old, and my son, his name is Cashon, and he's 6 years old. "Mama, I love you." That was the first thing they said was, "Mama, I love you," and that they missed me. I had two brothers incarcerated in the sting, and I had one sister. Right now, we're just really trying to get our families and stuff back together. My first thought was like, well, this has to be a racial thing, because, you know, they got most of all the blacks, really all the black generation, the younger generation, they put us all in jail. But I knew that there was injustice here because it's lack of jobs. It's hard for the black with black kids to get jobs here. It's very hard for us to get jobs here in Tulia. A few of us have applied at Thriftways, you know, like at the little grocery stores or whatever, and it's very few get on there. I've never been in trouble, had problems with the police or anything. I've never been in jail or anything, so I didn't realize that there was a lot of blacks incarcerated, you know, like it is until now. Well, no, I don't really have no harsh feelings towards them. I just want justice to be done, so we can put all this behind us and just continue to live our life with our families and our kids. So everybody, the ones that's got out, you know, we don't want to get no revenge. We just want to get justice done, and, you know, just so we can live our life, so we can move on, because some of us want to go to college, but until they clear our record, we're not allowed to go to college because of the felonies that we have. So right now we're just looking for, you know, like some kind of part-time job or full-time job, until all of this is over with, and then that way we can go to school. I was telling some of my friends in prison, I said, you know, I had a few interviews in prison, and I was telling my friends, I said, I see how a lot of those actors and a lot of those movie stars, how they begin to glorify themselves, and it's not about me. I give God all the glory for this and the attorneys, because it's because of them that made all of this happen.
This is On Point.